Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday morning. It is the 20th of March, and very nice to have you with us. So let me introduce everybody. A reminder that you can write to us. You can share your thoughts. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Let me just go around and introduce everybody. Political consultant Libby Post is here, normally with us on Monday, normally with us on Tuesday. Was not here either of those days, but is here on Wednesday because she's busy down at the legislature doing her job. So good morning. Thank you for Good morning.
Good morning. Nice. I'm really happy to be here.
We're thrilled to have you here. Thank you very much. Berkshire Eagle reporter extraordinaire Jen Smith was off last week. We missed her horribly, but she's back.
I am back.
Welcome back.
It's great to be here.
Yeah, well, I know. It's always great to return from vacation, isn't it?
Yeah, you know. But, you know, you got to just keep going.
Well, thank you very much. Very nice to have you with us. Former New York State Senator, SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor Terry Gibson is here as well. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, and happy spring to you and everyone.
Man, it feels good, doesn't it? Even I don't know, the sun was just coming up in the mountains. It was a beautiful morning, and I thought, yeah, this is what spring should be.
Well, before I came here, I did have to go to the legislature, and I parked on State Street and walked down to the Capitol because, you know, you can only get in before 9 o'clock at the Capitol. The LOB doors are locked. It was a little chilly. There was, there's a wind tunnel, and it was coming upstate, and I was walking downstate, but it's nicer now.
But I would argue that wind tunnel is always there, even in, like,
yes,
July.
Yes, I know, but it would be nice if it was a warmer
wind tunnel. I know. I'm glad you made it.
Yes.
Glad you survived that
ordeal. I did.
We welcome your letters, panel@WAMC.org. Alan is away today, but he'll be back tomorrow. So we miss him, but he'll be back. He'll be back with us tomorrow. All right. So we will go to what is making news, and a lot of weird stories today, sort of all over the board. This is one of those days where I was just going to ask you all beforehand, so what do you want to start with? But there's really, I don't know completely. Since we didn't do that, I'll start with the story about the Mueller report, which is, I think this is interesting. So the Washington Post has been working on a Freedom of Information Act request and trying to open some of Paul Manafort's records. They went to court, and then the response from the court was because of the press of other work, that is the term that they use, the press of other work, they have asked the judge to give them until April 1st to respond to the court about the request from the Washington Post. So then that leads you to wonder, oh, does that mean that they need until April 1st till they finish up the Mueller report, and then we'll know something by, yes, friends, April Fool's Day.
Ta-da!
Yeah, right.
So, and then, so there's really, this is a twofer, and then there's also, does the Washington Post do this because they really want the information, the redacted information on the Manafort, which I'm sure they do, but are they also doing it for exactly this reason, to get an idea of what the timing is of the Mueller report?
Well, I think there might be something like that involved. I do think that they wanted the other information. I mean, they're being good journalists, and they want the other information, and they should get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a little bit of both, maybe. I mean, that is sort of the power of the press, is that you can use Freedom of Information Act and other laws to, you know, support your investigations and to push some findings that are, you know, meant to be public. And, you know, the judge does have some rights and calls, too. And so it'll be interesting to see where these ends meet and what ultimately gets revealed in the public. I think in their request too, they did agree to some compromises of time frames, like certain updates, you know,
yeah, they
have
were
4 weeks
time. Whenever you're ready, just let us know. Yeah. Whenever you're ready, let us know, and we'll come and get the information.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the big thing that is frustrating for any journalist, especially the Washington Post, is that they receive all these documents, and then so much of it is just blacked out. And what one of the big questions is Donald Trump's name in one of those lines that is blacked out, or multiple lines that are blacked out? Mm-hmm. And it's very frustrating. Obviously, we would all love to know the answer to that.
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, we definitely do know a lot of information already in various conversations and reports that come out. I mean, we know who the players are, and I don't think that's the hard to guess. But I think it's the context that's missing when you get redacted items, and so it's expansive. I mean, it's 800 plus pages just in parts of the report alone, and then there's all this other circumstantial evidence. And so when you're part of a journalism team and you're in a 24-hour news cycle, you need time and planning. So you do want to keep abreast of what's going on. You do want to know that minute that, you know, the court clerk opens up that file and you can request it, and you want to be at the front of the line.
The Post has objected to the abundance of sealed and redacted records in Manafort's Washington case and petitioned the judge in his case, Amy Berman Jackson, to open them to a public view. The special counsel filing seeking the extension comes amid several public signs that the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election is winding down, and heightened speculation that Mueller could any day transmit his final report to Attorney General William Barr. That from the Washington Post. Then the question becomes, will we ever, how do we get our hands on it?
Oh, I think it'll be delivered directly. I think it'll get leaked and somebody will deliver it directly to the Post. I don't think that there's any question about that.
Well, also, and I think Barr is savvy enough to know that he's expected this much public pressure. And then you had, the Congress vote to say, like, yes, we're supporting this transparency. We need to see it. So if you perform an evasive maneuver and say, like, no, I'm still going to redact stuff, I think there's going to be a large, both public and also a congressional outcry.
Yeah, and I think to Libby's point, it is amazing that Mueller's been able to maintain the silence, the radio silence on this, and that nothing really has been leaked at all. But once he has, he loses that control and it's all transferred to a completely different department, somehow in that transfer, it's pretty easy to see that leaks will happen pretty quickly.
And, I think the fact that everyone in Congress, in the House, voted to release the report publicly, Republicans and Democrats, says something. Now, it could be, in my cynical mind, a strategy where the Republicans saying, well, look, the House Republicans said there are some Republicans who want it released, but the Senate doesn't think it should because we're a more austere and august body and blah, 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 blah. But, and Rod Rosenstein's not leaving so soon. So I think that's another signal about
another
how
part
they're
of the story.
This.
So yesterday we learned that Rod Rosenstein, who was supposed to, his end date was to be, quote, mid-March. And I guess the way he had set this up was that he would give the White House a 2-week notice as to when he was leaving, although he said, I expect it to be around mid-March. So yesterday it was announced that, A, he had not given the 2 weeks notice yet, and B, he was going to stay around longer than he expected to. We, again, are assuming that has to do from several published reports and broadcast reports that he has said that he has seen this investigation through and would like to see it through the end. So we can also assume from that that maybe they were thinking it was going to come out sooner, and now it's it's taking a little bit longer.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see whatever we do get to see. And, there's just no telling what's going to happen. And my fear is that it's not going to reveal the big smoking gun that we're all hoping that it will. And then we're going to be right back where we started, and we're going to have to remove this president by election, which is what I continue to believe is going to happen.
Well, that would be the case either way, right? I mean, even if there was a smoking gun, just the time stamp on this would indicate that an election would come before any other kind of action. Isn't that, I mean, are we at that point now?
Well, I don't think he'll get impeached. I don't think they'll do that. I think it might end up being he'll resign to cut a deal so his kids won't go to jail.
I
think, the Ivanka and Jared and the boys, Donald and Eric, they're all complicit in all of this. And I think unless he goes, and I've said this before, just like with Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen, oh, I really didn't know them. I mean, he could try to say that about his kids. But I think that that's a scenario that we could see coming down the pike.
Does he draw the line in terms of his values and morals at his family? Is that where he becomes like a human being? I'm not sure.
I think he does it at the line of Ivanka, but not the boys.
I mean, there was a book that was published by someone. There's a new book about the Kushners, mm-hmm. and somebody from the inside, and I'm blanking on what their position was, but the book came out last week. Anyway, the bombshell in that book the bombshell in that book was that at one point he had asked John Kelly to try to send the kids home to New York, mm-hmm. to get rid of them and send them back to New York. Mm-hmm. That's an answer to your question of, you know, where does that? So I mean, if that's true, I don't know. They didn't leave, tell you something, mm-hmm. but I don't know. Hmm. Okay. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. So meanwhile, we have murmurings.
Who?
Murmurings. You know that. Murmurings. That Joe Biden is ready. So there's a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal today that is... that I did send to the panel, but they probably couldn't open.
Right.
So,
but we won't say anything about that. But thank you for pointing that out.
But the former vice president is telling supporters. He told them yesterday that he intends to run for president and asked their help in lining up contributions from major donors so he can quickly raise several million dollars. So this comes as Beto O'Rourke, you will remember. We talked about this yesterday, raised $6.1 million in the 24 hours after he launched his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. This on the heels of Senator Bernie Sanders, collecting $5.9 million 24 hours after his announcement. So, not to be undone, the vice president, according to this article, has expressed concern that he wouldn't be able to raise millions of dollars in online donations immediately the way some of the other Democratic candidates have. Mr. Biden wants to announce a large fundraising number after his candidacy is official to better compete in what is often dubbed the money primary that kicks off a presidential season.
I think that he has a right to be concerned about that. I would be concerned if I was Joe Biden in terms of being able to get people excited with online small dollar contributions. I'm just not sure that that's what Joe Biden's personality does. I don't know that he can compete on that same level with a Beto O'Rourke or even a Bernie Sanders. I'm actually very interested and excited about this whole concept that the DNC has come up with this 65,000 donor limitation goal.
We'll jump into that too after the break.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
No, that's okay.
But it's all connected. It's all connected.
It is.
It's
all
putting
connected.
More pressure on these individual candidates to show that they are capable of getting grassroots supporters excited to contribute small amounts of money.
Yeah, I think Biden has a lot to reckon with, both from that standpoint and also kind of from his soul. I mean, what will this do at his age with his reputation too? We all know his platform is a lot different than the direction that the Democratic Party is moving in. And that ties again into getting those grassroots donations, which have tend to be garnered by more progressive candidates than Joe Biden. He's got a lot of other things to reckon with too, I think. Opponents will definitely dig into sort of his handsiness, if you will, and then the Me Too movement and other things that will be, challenged with his policies and stuff.
Not to be flip, but they will challenge him on all of the things that Trump has gotten away
absolutely.
With.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think what will determine, but I wonder if he'll get the same treatment in the media and how that will be taken. I mean, just mentioning these three candidates alone, even though we're in a field of how many now, like 15, 16, 17.
17. Well, if Biden announces it, it's 17.
But already we've seen an inequity in the amount of coverage that these candidates are getting, specifically because of this dollar amount issue. There's a lot of stake here.
One of the things that this is extremely anecdotal. I mean, I just want to put that out there as anecdotal. But I was at an event the other night, and they were talking politics, and people were talking about Beto, and they were talking about Elizabeth Warren, and they were talking about Gillibrand. They were talking about, they were not talking about Gillibrand, they were talking about Kamala Harris and every, you know, and the conversation. And then somebody said, but the big thing we're waiting for, and we expect it any day, is for Joe Biden to be president. And the people in the crowd went nuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, they went crazy. Mm-hmm. And then completely separate from that, I was watching the Colbert Report, or the dating myself now, the Late Show with David Colbert on CBS, and I was talking to talking to the audience, and was mentioning the article that we were talking about, and said, you know, and we expect any day now for Joe Biden to get into the race, and the crowd went nuts. And I know we had Robert Griffin on last week, and called I think maybe appropriately called him the warm blanket candidate of, you know, somebody that's cozy that we like. Is that what we're seeing here?
Well, I think we're looking for someone who's the anti-Trump, who's a nice person. Joe puts that out there. He also, I'm looking at it from a practical point of view, he can bring in back some of those disaffected white working class men who feel the party has, you know, abandoned them, but he can talk to them in their language. He comes from the same background. You know, he's from hardscrabble Scranton, Pennsylvania. And I think that there's a lot of negatives out there that people keep piling up on Biden. But, you know, he did win national office twice as vice president. We can't deny that. And we can't deny that he was crucial to Obama's election. He really helped deliver those white working class voters.
He's also a really seasoned guy, and especially in dealing with the global community. I think he has a lot of support from other, global gubernatorial players. He had pretty much an endorsement during the security conference a week or two ago, encouraging him to run. And that's something I'm sure his team is taking into factor too. But can they mobilize, you know, outside and inward?
Well, we can't let the good get in the way of the, we can't let the perfect get in the way of the good. And that's, and the Democrats and all the Democrats and everyone on the left have to coalesce behind whoever the Democratic candidate is, even if that person is not perfect. Kamala Harris, for some people, is not perfect because she was a prosecutor. You know, Pete Buttigieg, I think that's how you say his name, the South Bend mayor, who's a gay man, who's made the threshold because he's gotten 65,000 donations or donors. You know, he's going to have the baggage of being a gay man. And so, you know, no one in this field is going to be perfect, but we have to look at what the most important thing is, which is getting rid of Trump.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, Libby Post, and your letters next. Dell and Dog is playing at the they're playing at the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, better known as Dell McCrory and David Grisman. The date, Friday, this Friday, the 22nd. You can find out more by going to troymusichall.org. They are providing our bumper music this morning. So Dell and Dog. And again, you can find out more at troymusichall.org. We always have our playlist online, wamc.org/roundtable. Okay, we have letters. Is everyone ready? Robert writes, I'd like to be as confident as you seem to be about the Mueller report being released or leaked. Unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember that parts of the Warren Commission report on JFK's assassination and of the 9/11 report on the Saudi involvement in the attack are still not available to the public. The government is very good at keeping some secrets. Anybody? No? Okay.
Well, let's just remember that the Pentagon Papers and all the Watergate stuff did come out, and that's what I'm looking at as the model here.
In a email sent to us from Deborah with a subject line that simply says, Ivanka, I've always thought that Trump will only leave when Ivanka says, Daddy, it's over. I don't know what would make her recognize that point, but I believe / hope that we're getting there and that they have enough care for each other that she would say it and he would go. I agree with Libby that he probably cares more for her than for Eric and Don Jr. Well, who knows? I mean, we can't get into the minds of the machinations of family.
Well, I mean, he's on the record of saying if he wasn't if she wasn't his daughter.
I don't say that. That's icky.
Well, let's not forget. Well, but he is icky.
I know. Right.
I mean, come on. This is a man who exudes ick when you want to think of it in that, those terms.
President Ick.
It's President Ick. Right.
John says, as I am 79 years old, I have a lot of experience with old news. Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders are old news. Bernie has only released a two-page summary of his 2014 taxes. Joe has enough baggage to fill a word I don't know, but let's assume it's something big. And he says, love the show.
Good.
Well,
all right.
We love you too.
Maureen writes about the DNC and the money. It looks good to have DNC promote small donations, but from my point of view, they evaluate candidates based on their ability to raise campaign funds, and quite honestly, I find it disgusting. It's always about the money.
Well, just to be fair, and I don't want to jump ahead, but...
No, you can jump ahead.
Well, is when we talk about this later, we'll point out the fact that it's not just about the money. You can actually be a part of this debate process just by ranking 1% in the polls, which has nothing to do with money, although it does, because to get into the polls at that level, you need to spend some money on advertising. So it is all related.
We go to this from we go from that to this. David says that you said it the best I've heard it pronounced. The mayor
Buttigieg.
Mm-hmm. Pete Buttigieg seems to be dismissed so easily and not taken seriously. Why is that? Well, probably just name recognition, and because like me, they have trouble pronouncing his
name. Yeah, and I'm not dismissing him. I mean, he's got a good base. He's coming out of nowhere, and it seems, you know, South Bend, Indiana. He's the mayor. I think there are a lot of people who are jazzed about him, and I can tell you the gay community is taking notice.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes just stepping out there to run in a campaign is a good way to build up name recognition for future campaigns.
That's right. Well, I think that's a lot of this. Yeah. I really do.
For a lot of the candidates.
Yeah, for a lot of the candidates. Yeah.
Kevin writes, superficial. He said, you are being pretty superficial about Biden. Who can run the government? Who can put it back on track? Period. Libby is right.
Thank you.
I think we were all sort of in agreement, weren't we, on that one? Kind of. Michael says, the man has run for president twice. This is about Joe Biden. You may have figured that out already. He has run for president twice. I think he's run for president three times. Mm-hmm. I think that is, I'd have to look that up, but I believe that's the case. And he wasn't not very good at it either time. He has Anita Hill baggage, and he consistently been susceptible to foot and mouth syndrome. Can't stop talking once he gets going, and no one knows where it goes. A bit like Trump in that way. And all due respect, he is 78 years old. That is a fact. It's only March. Iowa is a year away.
All interesting points.
All interesting points indeed. Again, we were talking about this during the break, but a year ago, 4 years ago at this time, Jeb Bush had all the money.
Right.
On the Republican side.
Right.
And that did not work out too well
and
for
him.
And
that's something I'm personally still watching too, is will there be a candidate that runs on the Republican side against Trump who is really viable?
Well, Bill Weld is nothing to laugh at. I mean, he was something to laugh at when he ran as a libertarian. But I think if he can find his roots again, I think he's a smart guy. He's socially liberal. And he could, you know, I mean, it'll be harder for him to get the votes on the far right. But I think he could be someone who could give Trump a challenge.
What about Kasich? Mm.
I think Kasich, too. I mean, Kasich is a rational human being. I don't agree with him on many issues, but he's the anti-Trump. They're both the anti-Trump within the Republican Party in terms of personality type.
But can either of those candidates win the party, you know, support back from the support of
Trump? Well, not when there's 90% of the Republicans say they back Trump.
It'll be interesting to see what kind of rules the Republican Party comes up with in terms of who can stand on the debate stage for the Republicans if there is a primary.
Mm. All right. I want to read the first line of this article from the Washington Post about the Democratic debates. And this is I just like this line, so that's why I'm going to read it. The latest turn in the Democratic presidential race looks a bit like an infomercial for a food dehydrator or Ginsu knives. Former Congressman John Delaney stands in front of a whiteboard in an online video pitching voters on a new way to double their money. It's really simple. It's actually a pretty good deal, the Maryland Democrat says. You give one, I give two to a charity of your choice. You heard that right, folks. A candidate for president wants your donation so badly he's willing to pay twice as much out of pocket. The reason has little to do with traditional campaign fundraising and a lot to do with the new criteria the Democratic Party has laid out for qualifying for the first debates. Either earn at least 1% support in a series of public polls or attract 65,000 individual donors, one or the other. Hitting 65,000 has become a magic ticket for many of the party's presidential candidates who are struggling to rank in public polls given a field that already has 15 contenders with several more waiting in the wings. The new criteria has proved to be a boon to lesser-known candidates seeking a national stage this summer and could create challenges for more established politicians seeking to break away from the pact with unpredictable repercussions for the party. My question, okay, so what do you make of that?
Well, I just wanted to point out, Joe, that
sorry,
is there someone else here? I dug a little deeper into this. Just to be clear, it's a little more complicated than just 65,000 donors. It has to be 65,000 unique donors in 20 states with 200 donors per state.
Wow.
So it is a little more complicated. But me personally, I'm very excited about this idea. I like the idea that someone who wants to run for public office, for the highest office in our country, has to get 65,000 individual people to contribute at least $1, I suppose. I don't know what counts as, but I think, I don't know what is it a dollar?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so $65,000, you can stand on the debate stage, theoretically, and debate to be president of the United States. I think that's pretty cool.
So how does it work then in future debates? I mean, is that going to be that's going to be the benchmark for every debate?
No, that is just for this debate. Things are going to get, the bar is going to get much higher as we move forward. This is just the initial out of the gate. They mentioned that in a couple of different articles, that the level of being able to qualify for debate is going to get harder and harder as we move forward.
But we want democracy, too. But it is hard to hear from 15, 17, 18 people at one time as well. Mm-hmm. And so do we not hear from those people at all then, or will they go to a secondary debate?
I think that it's all going to depend. They haven't set those rules yet, as best I can tell. But I think the initial purpose here is to try to change the landscape from the 2016 campaign, where we had the Clinton campaign really running the show and constantly at odds with the Sanders campaign. They don't want that dynamic to exist again. They want to try to be transparent. They want to try to give everyone who seems to be a legitimate candidate a shot, at least one shot, of national recognition on the stage with everyone else. And I think it's going to make a big difference because it's going to hold the more established candidates accountable to the younger candidates. And I think it's going to be pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing where it becomes a little bit more than just beyond name recognition. I mean, it challenges the candidates by far to do more work. They really have to get themselves out there. Their team, they really have to mobilize their teams and across all different states. You know, we can see the concentric circles from where a candidate's based and you know what ripples outwards. But you know how I mean, that's a game that everyone is going to have to play. And it makes you, I think, hopefully more aware of what's happening in different states as well. I think what the other thing we'll see is, you know, how this sets precedent for raising the bar and the way that the bar will be raised, because you do have to kind of fight for it. I mean, it's a competition at the end of the day.
It is a competition, and we've stressed both during our break and on the air, this is all extremely early. Mm-hmm. We have a long way to go. A year to the first vote is cast, and a lot can happen, and we don't know.
A lot can happen, and the field will expand and contract until we get down to it, and we'll see who actually comes through in the Iowa caucuses, but it is really, really early, and everybody's like, well, who are you going to support now, and who are you going to support now? It's like, when we see who's real, then we can make some of those decisions.
Mm-hmm. And I think it'll start, you know, as we progress, I think whatever the national temperature is on certain issues will also affect things. You know, mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago, we were all really focused on, you know, the border wall and things like that. Now we're looking at a lot more other issues, whether it's the Mueller report, whether mm-hmm. It's the manufacturing industry and such. So I think any of those things could be the issue that, you know, challenges people to think otherwise and to look at candidates differently. It'll be a challenge for these candidates to stay on top of everything, too, and to be able to come out with a clear message instead of flip-flopping. Although I think the tolerance for that has changed, shifted in the country, too.
Well, it's all
less
according who you are. It really is all according who you are.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're standing on the stage with 10 other candidates a year away from the primary, you know, you're really only going to get maybe 30 seconds, maybe 60 seconds to make an impression mm-hmm. because everyone has to get their piece in. So it's going to happen pretty quick. People mm-hmm. are going to get a pretty quick snapshot of these individuals, and I think the field will get narrowed down pretty quickly after that.
Alan mentioned this yesterday, and it's a great point. I think that the job that a lot of the cable news networks are doing of giving the hour and a half to the candidates to come out and to talk and to have that town hall experience. At this point in the game, I think John Hickenlooper is next up mm-hmm. for CNN. It's been really fascinating and is good. I mean, if we want to get to know these people and we want to hear what they have to say, because this is another issue we can get into, but certainly I know this has been the wrap on Beto O'Rourke. Is talking a good game, but not a lot in details. Right. So far, two pages have been released on what his policies are, and mm-hmm. we don't really know that. So putting it to the test and having people get to ask questions is a pretty important part of the process. I'm just wondering in some way if those are even more important than the debates where you can actually stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, just remember we do have a president who has yet to put out any real details about anything on policy and never did during his campaign. So I'm not sure if that continues to be a qualification to be president, as sadly as that sounds. I think personality appeal, rock star appeal mm-hmm. has a lot to do with how the American public goes about choosing their president.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Terry Gibson, Jen Smith, Libby Post, and your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
I'm leaving today. I'm going, but I ain't coming back.
Del and Dog performing at the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall Friday night. It's Del McCoury and David Grisman, troymusichall.org. And you can find more on our website about the playlist, the music we're playing, by going to wamc.org/roundtable. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith is here. Former New York State Senator and SUNY New Paltz Communications Professor Terry Gibson joins us. Political consultant Libby Post is here. Alan is out today, but we'll be back tomorrow. And we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Thank you very much.
O-R-G.
Sorry. And I'm sorry. I was looking at an AOL address, and I got all mixed up. I'm sorry.
Who has an AOL address?
You got mail.
Yeah, that's right. You got mail. Bob says, I'm intrigued by a number of the early Democratic announced candidates, but the main issue in beating Trump is voter turnout. If enough people actually vote, Trump and his Republicans will not win. The Democrats are recruiting and training the next generation of campaign organizers. I think this is a fantastic idea. Look up Organizing Corps 2020 to find out more. If you're a college junior, sign up by April 8th.
That's right.
Sounds good.
There you go.
You work with young people, Terry. Get going.
I think it's great. I agree with the writer. I'm very excited about this idea. I think it's good for democracy. I think it's very good for the Democratic Party. And I think the American public is going to get a chance to meet a lot of very talented, creative people with some interesting ideas.
All right, let's go to this letter from John. A lot of these are about Joe Biden. Esteemed panel. Uh-oh. Joe Biden doesn't want to be president. Anyone who was serious about wanting to be president wouldn't be playing the game of, I don't know, I haven't decided yet, twice now. He's done this twice. Biden's purpose, as well as so many other establishment Democrat choices crowding the field, are part of the DNC's intention to once again Reagan steal the primary for their choice of nominee. The more crowded and chaotic the primary process, the easier it will be for the party to divide up all the voters and hide shenanigans with the polling and voting and all the dust that's kicked up, all to achieve a second round of voting at the convention where they can use their superdelegates to install their own candidate.
Yeah.
is that your expert opinion and advice on that topic?
The problem Joe has is that, well, it's not really a problem, is that without doing really anything, with just sort of being alive and doing really no campaigning, his name continues to be at the top of most of the polls that are taken. So even without trying to be president, people in the polls keep saying they want to consider him as president. So how
so
do you deal
with that?
Will it
be a matter of actualization, essentially?
Right. I mean, wouldn't it be great to be considered a candidate for president when you're not even campaigning to be one?
What if we get a write-in campaign? I don't know.
So, but I mean, from all practicalities, we believe, first of all, the last time, I think the letter is somewhat unfair in that the last time he backed out, his son had just passed away.
Right.
And,
yes.
And I think, you know, I know we're all cynical, but I certainly think that took its toll, and he wasn't ready and didn't feel that he could give it his all. And so there's that. And now it's probably just a matter of what we talked about at the beginning of the program, of making sure that you have the money and you have the support and that you're not doing it for nothing, right? Mm-hmm.
And he's got the name recognition. I mean, this is really important when you're running for any office, but certainly as president, people want to know the name and feel comfortable with who that person is. And there's no one except for possibly Bernie Sanders, I would suppose, since he's done it already before, that has the type of name recognition. And I think if I've seen the polls correctly, Bernie is the only one who really threatens him in the polls at this particular time.
Right.
All right. We got this. That's John's letter. Thank you, John. We got this from Jade. Happy spring. Biden. No. We want and need change. Biden has had his time for a long time, very similar to Hillary, the loser. As a 63-year-old, I want a younger person with contemporary ideology. I am a lesbian. I do not live in a gay community. I am not aware of a gay community, just as I am not aware of a straight community. I don't separate myself in such a way. Love and kisses, Jade. Yes. All right. I think that was to you, Libby, but...
Okay.
All right.
Well, I'm sorry that you don't live in a gay community and you're not aware of a gay community. There are
I think
gay
it was your comment about Pete.
Buttigieg. But the fact is that...
I don't know. I wonder if I can get that by the end of the show.
I don't know.
Buttigieg. I have faith in you.
Buttigieg. Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, the fact is that there are communities. There are gay communities. There are LGBT people living together. And it's not necessarily we're all living on the same block. It's about forming community and having safety and feeling part of a group of people. So I don't...
Hillary says, I find Pete Buttigieg fascinating, clear, smart, and hopeful. He may not end up being the Democratic nominee, but I sure hope he influences the conversation with his intelligence, intellect, tenor, clarity, and future focus. I think I added the word intelligence. It was just intellect, so I apologize. If anyone can make being gay a non-issue, Buttigieg can do it. I know that I'm not supposed to send a link, so please listen to the Preet Bharara interview with Buttigieg. It is very refreshing. So that is on Preet's podcast, I assume. Daisy agrees. Pete Buttigieg is my favorite candidate, says he. We must not waste this opportunity. We need to nominate someone who will be bold enough to make structural changes. He says there is no looking back. Joe Biden is not that candidate. Pete, Elizabeth Warren are those candidates.
Yeah, well, a big part of the American public, especially the younger part of the public, really wants to see significant radical change, and the status quo just won't do. And it's hard to argue that Joe is not part of the status quo.
And I don't think it's just the younger part of the public either. I think it's just people, again, seeking change. And I think that's what we saw with the last election, even though, you know, Bernie didn't get in, obviously, he did change the conversation. And I think that's something that maybe people are clamoring for, too. Who's going to change the conversation and who's going to put something on the table that looks like it will actually change the conversation. I think that's something that some of the new voters are, those outlier voters that could potentially be mobilized, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for what will motivate them to go to the polls.
So I'm getting to that. This is what is really going to take over the listenership this morning. So okay, I've got a couple of emails here.
Okay.
So it's boot. I'm the is they say boot edge.
Really?
Is what one listener is telling us. That's what Matt is telling us. Our news director is saying that it is Buttigieg.
Okay, I'm going to look it up. And
So I believe in the rock, paper, scissors, I go with our news director. But Buttigieg. So whatever we decide at the end of this hour conversation, if someone could just print this out and put it on the wall here, or I'll tattoo it on my arm. And yep, we'll be ready.
If you can't make a bumper sticker out of it pretty quickly, you have a problem running for president.
Right.
But we got, you know what? I'll say, we were always having problems with Kamala Harris. And I have to say, Libby was my savior because she just said it's Kamala.
Right.
It's that easy. Kamala.
That's his easy. His name is Maltese.
Yes.
And it roughly translates to Lord of the Poultry.
What are we talking about?
Yeah. And.
So far, none of this is what
he went with in
what
a Medium
we seeking, Libby.
Post from 2016. He went with
Buttigieg.
Okay.
Well, all right.
Buttigieg.
Well, maybe someone can call his office and figure it out.
Well, we can actually watch a video with audio. But we'll do that on the break.
We have a break in just a minute. Okay. We'll do that. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. It seems like we're going to be talking about this man a lot more over the next several weeks.
Indiana.
So we want to make sure that that we
Mr.
get
South
it.
South Bend.
So I have another one. It's Buttigieg. And then I have another one that says Buttigieg. We now are clocking about 15 emails on the name pronunciation.
Let's see if we can make
and by
50
the way,
by the end of the show.
About 14 different ones, yeah, too. Right. So that's good.
Thank you, fact checkers.
Good advertising.
I just want you to know
this alone will get him the nomination.
We're trying to get it right. It's not just doing it for good radio, although hopefully that works out too. All right, let's take a break. Ray Graff is in his spot ready to deliver the news. I promised him I would get to him on time. We will take a break. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 20th of March. And we have a fantastic panel. Alan Shartok is away today, but he'll be here tomorrow, so we miss him horribly. But we're trying to keep up the quality here and doing our best here. So Libby Post is with us. Good
yes,
morning,
I
Libby.
Am.
How are you? I'm sorry to point at you. I'm
it's
just
okay,
trying
honey.
To think of words.
You've got this. You're going to get through. You're going to be fine.
I'm now worried about pronouncing everyone's name right. I think I have this Smith, right? Jen Smith. And Terry Gibson joins us. We
now,
welcome
it's,
everyone.
It's Gibson with a P, just to be clear, since we're into name
you know,
pronunciation
to,
this morning.
I had to,
so,
right. I had to when you first started with us, I used to
underline.
Yeah, put a little bold on that just so I'd remember.
Yeah, it's part of my life story. Gibson with a P.
Gibson with a P. So I think we've come up with a universal definition or a universal pronunciation of the mayor's name. And because during the break, we listened to him pronounce it because a reporter, a very smart reporter, said, how do we pronounce your name? So it's many people have been writing in and saying it's Buttigieg, which is sort of, if you put it all together quick, is right. But the way that the campaign is doing the phonetic way of doing it is not judge, but jedge.
Right.
So
Buttigieg.
It's Buttigieg.
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 Right. And let me just say, you just brought in a book by Mitch Landrieu.
Yes.
I think he's going to enter the race late, and I think he could win.
Is that the New Orleans?
Yes, the New Orleans mayor. I think he will get into this once the field sort of clears a little bit and he sees what he's really dealing with, and he could win.
That's interesting.
Now, he's one of the people on the bubble, right? He has not announced one way or the other.
Right.
He is going to be our guest today at 10:30.
Oh,
we'll ask him the question that everyone else is asking him, and he won't answer it.
Right. Well, of course not.
But we'll talk about other stuff, and that's important, too. Okay. So let us go to other things and find out. I have to say, we got a lot of letters, but again, they were all on the pronunciation of the name. So that's where we got held up this morning.
I'm glad the details matter to the people. That makes me happy as a journalist.
Right. That's true.
All right. Pete Buttigieg. I got it. All right. Now we go to some other stories that are making news, and we talk about, this is a big one, really, as far as science news. This is one of the biggest stories that we've talked about in a long time. The FDA has approved its first drug for postpartum depression. The medication works quickly, within 48 hours. It's an expensive infusion and requires a stay in a medical center. That's bad. But if you are suffering, then we'll do with what we can, it's better than nothing, right? The first drug for women suffering postpartum depression received federal approval on Tuesday, a move likely to pave the way for a wave of treatments to address a debilitating condition that is the most common complication of pregnancy. Here's the good side of it. The drug works very quickly, within 24 hours. That's a significant improvement over current available antidepressants, which can take 2 to 4 weeks to have an effect, if they work at all. Experts say the new treatment will prove immediate relief for mothers whose depression keeps them from providing their babies with the care, bonding, and nurturing that is crucial for healthy development. As many as 1 in 7 American women, think of that, 1 in 7 American women experience depression during or after pregnancy. Postpartum depression is a serious condition that, when severe, can be life-threatening. According to the acting director of the Division of Psychiatry Products at the Food and Drug Administration Center for Drug Evaluation and Research.
Put that on a business card.
It's on her business card. It's on Tiffany Francione's business card. This approval marks the first time a drug has been specifically approved to treat postpartum depression, providing an important new treatment option. There are limitations to the new drug. I'm not even gonna. It. I believe it's pronounced brexanolone, but since this medication is not running for president, I really don't want to go through the whole thing about how we pronounce it. Which will be marketed as Zulresso,
right?
Which is delivered by infusion over 60 hours, during which a new mother must remain in a certified medical center under supervision. She could get dizzy or faint, as several patients did in clinical trials. There are side effects to everything.
Well, you know, I'm just glad that we're in the 21st century in 2019.
And we're actually talking about this.
Right. We're actually taking some women's health care issues seriously. I mean,
I'm sorry, but can I just add one step to that?
Sure.
I agree with you completely. I'm also happy that we're just taking mental health seriously.
This is true.
I mean, one step
further. Well, it's one thing this presidency has done for us is that we are taking mental health issues much more seriously because of who's in the White House. But, you know, it's taken so long for women's health issues to really come into a primary focus. And postpartum depression, you know, everybody would just poo-poo it in the past. Oh, just get a grip. You know, you're okay. Look, you have a baby. How can you be depressed? Mm-hmm. You know, but it's a real physiological response. You know, your hormones are all over the place after you have a kid. And I'm really just glad that we're starting to take this seriously. I'm hoping that the pill that they talked about this will end up being approved and workable a little sooner than
an infusion.
Yeah,
right.
An infusion.
And
then
there's a pill alternative that they're
working
looking
on
for.
Right. I'm hoping that becomes available. I mean, $34,000. You know, I was talking to somebody about some other healthcare stuff yesterday and insurance coverage. It'll be interesting to see what the insurance companies do.
Well,
with this.
I think that's my big concern because, I mean, the statistics show this affects a lot of people, you know, but will the insurance industry keep up with that and say, you know, and also I hope this promotes a discussion of what other side effects this can have. So maybe it does push the insurance industry to say, like, all right, we have to work with these these people either to figure out how to subsidize or make more accessible the cost. I mean, it's something brand new, so the cost is always going to be high. And I think it also hopes it continues, it encourages rather the conversation around additional support that we provide. I mean, mm-hmm. you provide things like a lactation counselor or something when a family is, you know, when they get a new baby. But what other supports does a new mother need? I think, you know, when you see someone who just has a baby, there's all this support. You have a baby shower and things like that. And then you have a kid and suddenly you're on your own.
Yes.
And even if you've had a child before, sometimes you can still have these feelings. And there's just so many other issues that are around other issues with birth, whether beyond postpartum too. You know, I think there's just a lot of, how do you take care of your health? How do you find the support? How do people take it seriously? Right. How do you share the load?
And how do we stop people from shaming others for slights? I read yesterday that there was a woman who walked into Target, I think, mm-hmm. and she had a toddler, a two-year-old, and a newborn, or a three-month-old. And the toddler's going through its terrible twos and, you know, screaming and yelling, and the mother picked it up, put her under her arm, and she got mom shamed by mm-hmm. another person. It's like mm-hmm. nobody knows what shoes you're in. Mm-hmm. So, you know, stop that.
Well, and another issue, too, with this is that we know now that there are so many inequities around birth, especially when it comes to people of color.
That's right. The report just came out from the governor's office.
Exactly. So I think that needs to be taken into factor too, about, again, the importance. I wonder if women of color are even more highly susceptible to postpartum depression. I'd love to see mm-hmm. the data on that. I haven't fully read the study yet, so it may indicate that there. But will that, again, push insurance companies to say, like, these are really high-risk folks that need access to supports and options like this?
I think affordability is going to be a big part of this discussion. This release of this new details about this new drug is, I think, going to play into the whole conversation you're going to be hearing from the Democratic presidential candidates about universal health care, Medicare for all, affordability and access to good quality health care, the income inequality that we have in this country that is denying many individuals access to drugs like this. Like $34,000. Who can afford that? How are insurance companies going to respond? And is this going to put more pressure on them to be more accessible to everyone? We'll see.
We certainly will see. But, I mean, any advances, and it is, as you say,
good.
It's good that we're talking about that. And may I just say for a moment, and maybe this is trite, but yay science.
I was just going to say that.
We love science.
Yay science.
That's right.
Good job.
Science is good.
Doesn't seem like we're perhaps spending enough time saying
Yay science.
All right. Let's go to other stories. And I want to talk about the Boeing's issues and the FAA. Again, this is sort of a science story, too, really, isn't it?
Science and ethics story, I would venture.
Science and ethics. I think you're absolutely right. So the FAA approval of the Boeing jet involved in two crashes comes under scrutiny as regulators at the FAA, otherwise known as the Federal Aviation Administration, reviewed designs for Boeing's newest passenger jet. They paid extra attention to several features, including the lithium batteries, the pressure fueling system, and the inflatable safety slides. One feature that did not receive exceptional scrutiny, a new software system intended to prevent stalls. That same software is suspected of playing a role in two deadly crashes involving the same jet, the Boeing 737 MAX. Authorities around the world are now taking a closer look at the jet's approval by the FAA, a process that relies heavily on Boeing employees to certify the safety of the plane. The 737 MAX was one of the first commercial jets approved under new rules, which delegated more authority to Boeing than had been the case when most previous planes were certified, and the software system did not raise warnings during the approval process. Top FAA officials who are briefed on significant safety issues were not aware of the software system, according to three people with knowledge of the process, and that is from the New York Times.
I mean, just from, let's going back to science for a moment, if you look at the software system, basically it's using an algorithm that sort of defies or locks in physics and doesn't allow the pilot to kind of override that. And so I think that's part of what's being investigated here. The fact that people weren't even aware of this system blows my mind.
And the fact that Boeing is overseeing itself, it's like the fox guarding the hen house.
Exactly.
Well, if you look at, if you remember when Facebook and Google came before Congress and testified, we saw right then that our government is being run primarily by a bunch of old white men that have no idea how technology works, mm-hmm. have no mm-hmm. idea how software works, have no idea what social media is. And I think that that has something to do with the fact that our government has essentially turned over the responsibility of building aircraft in a safe manner that relies on technology to the company itself, which is very dangerous. Mm-hmm. Our government is not providing the proper oversight and is getting way too close to the corporate barons that are building these machines.
Mm-hmm. So my other question is, why did not our government see this matter the way that the European government and the Canadian government have seen it and decided on by their own volition to ground those planes?
Because this government thinks anything that business does is just okay. If they're making money, they must be doing something right. That's all they care about.
This is a real crisis management situation for Boeing, and I think even the FAA to some degree.
Say, mm-hmm.
And, you know, they both have a lot of credibility to lose here, and they've both already lost a lot. I mean, Boeing has withstood things like this in the past, but the FAA really, well, they have a new director coming in now, right?
Right.
We have
some,
a new person that's been appointed, and we'll see what he does. But something is going to have to be done here to put the public's trust back in a government entity that's tasked with inspecting
and tell that to the 400 plus families mm-hmm. who won't have a passenger coming back. I mean, we lost a young girl from our area in the Berkshires mm-hmm. from Sheffield. You know, that's no this investigation now is no comforting manner to these families who are already lost due to lack of oversight.
Well, and these are we're asking the people who have no faith in government, the people in government right now who don't have faith in government, who don't think government should be overseeing business, to asking them to do the right thing. And they don't know what the right thing is, nor do they really care. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Trump had to be pushed to say something about the crash. Though people on that plane were the other to him, and he doesn't care. Mm-hmm. And neither does Stephen Miller. He probably did a little jig because a lot of people of color died in that crash. I mean, this is the kind of mentality
Libby,
we're dealing with.
Libby.
No.
Come on.
These are the kind of people we're dealing with in this administration.
I don't think
they
anyone
don't care.
Is dancing over the
now,
death
I don't
of
think,
people.
I don't think Stephen Miller cared. I don't think the president cared.
All right.
I mean, the president's being pushed by people to disown white supremacists, and he's refusing to do it.
There's other areas, though. I mean, clearly we have way more questions than we have answers in this matter. But, I mean, why didn't people know about this? I mean, is mm-hmm. it because of lack of training? Is it because of lack of funding in this area? I mean, these are
'cause Boeing didn't tell
questions.
Anybody?
You know, for sure, it's all a possibility. But again, what will the government do in the meantime? Will they step up and join the European agencies and the Canadian agencies to say, stop?
But this issue with the FAA and Boeing being too close goes way back before Trump was ever even thinking about running for president. There's just been a slow process of giving more and more responsibility to Boeing and less oversight by mm-hmm. a government entity. And so I think we have to blame multiple administrations for that. And I think we have to blame the lack of transparency in our democracy for that. And consumer protection has got to be at the top of the priority list of our government, and whether it comes to planes, food, water. And in all those areas, you're seeing more and more situations where the government is really asleep at the wheel and not looking out for our best
interests. Well, it's not trusting the people who are experts in these fields to if they say they're trusting, they're not listening. I think that's the big problem.
They don't trust science. They don't trust facts. Everything is up for debate. And not everything should be up for debate anymore.
We shouldn't have to wait for planes to crash before
That's
we take
right.
action. We shouldn't have to wait for people to get cancer from drinking the water before we take action. And we shouldn't have to wait for people die of some disease for eating food before we take action. I mean, you know, we need to have scientists in place that are doing the studies that are being funded properly by the government. We need to have a government that supports that type of funding, which we don't currently have. And that's the way you go about preventing these types of things from happening. Otherwise, you're just always out there responding to the crisis mm-hmm. instead of trying to not have a crisis in the first place.
I do want to clarify something that you said earlier, Terry, about the new the FAA chief, President Trump, picked former Delta executive Stephen Dixon as the FAA chief yesterday, his choice to become the permanent head of the Federal Aviation Administration. Mr. Dixon will be nominated for the post amid intensifying calls worldwide for the aviation agency to explain its approval of the Boeing 737 MAX, which is what we've been talking about. Mr. Dixon retired as Delta senior vice president of flight operations last fall after a 27-year career at the company. And we should say that the agency has been run by an acting administrator, Daniel Elwell, since January of 2008.
And let's not forget, this person ends up working for Elaine Cho, right, mm-hmm. who's the transportation secretary. And who is she married to? Mm-hmm. She's married to Mitch McConnell.
Yeah, yeah, that's another relationship that has mm-hmm. always bothered me, and I think it should bother us. I mean, the president of the United States Senate is married to the head of the transportation mm-hmm. department of our country, and again, you're not creating a situation that is ethical. You're creating a situation that is not transparent, and it's just not in the best interest of the country to operate like that.
We are out of time. My thanks to everybody for your letters, for tuning in, for your pronunciation advice. We appreciate it. Wibby Post, thank you very much.
You're welcome,
Jen
dear.
Smith
thank you.
Terry Gibson.
Thank you
very much for being with us. We will be back with more Roundtable after this.